We have Earl Lane of the Center for Integrative Psychology at Columbia Pacific University in Santa Cruz, California. Mr. Lane holds degrees in transpersonal psychology and psychotronics. He has authored two books in the field, Electrophotography and Rainbows of Life. Earl has conducted research in psychotronics and studies on wound healing and biofeedback. His electronics background includes design, manufacturing, and marketing. He's lectured extensively, both in this country and abroad, and has taught psychology, parapsychology, electronics, and photography. Earl's presentation today is Psychotronics Technology, A Look at the State of the Art. Earl?
Look at the state of the art. Look at this thing. One of the things we'll be getting into a little bit later is a look at the state of the art of some of the component aspects of psychotronics. Since it's an incredibly interdisciplinary science involving electronics and psychology and physics and mathematics, consciousness research. First thing I wanted to do was give you a little bit more of an introduction so you can tell where I'm coming from in terms of my presentation. As a historical note, my affinity for light and electricity goes back to when I was about 7 years old. My affinity for one other thing and almost a total infatuation with a man, Nikola Tesla, and his work. The first book that I wrote, which I don't have a copy of here, I have it in the room, however, is called Electrophotography. That book was dedicated to Nikola Tesla. Very important man. Very important in a lot of different ways, in electricity and electronics. A lot of things were put together by Tesla that people still don't recognize him for. For example, the alternating current polyphase system of electricity, which we use throughout the world, was created by Tesla, came to the United States and harnessed Niagara Falls and put on all the lights in New York City without a drawing from his head. He had eidetic memory. Spent about 10 years in the electronics industry, primarily with Fairchild Semiconductor, doing design and research. A lot of work in microcircuits. Got interested in transpersonal psychology and went and got a degree in that, focused on biofeedback, acupuncture, Curling photography, that kind of research, as it applied to the nature of the mind and the nature of consciousness. Beyond that, I went and got involved in psychotronics, prepared a manuscript called Electrophotography for part of my master's work, did research in consciousness in South America, Central America, and the United States, traveled around, photographed with Curlian apparatus a lot of different kinds of phenomenon, some of which I'll be showing you here. The research in the past has been primarily biofeedback, acupuncture, and Curlian photography, as well as the Baxter effect. Biofeedback from the standpoint of working with primarily hemispherical laterality, the two sides of the brain, working with people with various kinds of muscular disorders, with EMG to reactivate their muscular tissue, acupuncture, electroacupuncture. We'll talk a little bit about the state of the art in terms of those fields. So I think at this point, Paul, if you would, you want to turn the first slide on. I think what we need to do is talk about where are we really, really. The Earth turns on its axis at 1,000 miles per hour. It rotates around the Sun at 20 miles per second. The solar system moves within the star system at 13 miles per second. The star system within the Milky Way at 200 miles per second. The Milky Way drifts through the universe at 100 miles per second. All these events are going on right now, simultaneously, in a whole lot of different directions. Where are we really? Could I have the next slide? The point of an interdisciplinary science... No, Paul, push the little button on the side. Yeah.
I am.
Not the big one for your thumb. There's a small one. There's a little tiny button there on the side.
Oh, I see.
It goes both ways. If you get it right... Oops, wrong way. Push it twice the other way. That's it. That's it. Okay. Thank you. One of the things that we have to keep in mind in the study of psychotronic phenomenon is that what we are looking at is fields within fields within fields within fields. We're looking at fields in terms of, for example, in Curlian photography, I have to consider the fact that electromagnetic fields from the moon and from other planets, lunar tides, the solar tides are all affecting the photographs, as well as at the particle physics level, things are changing around, and they're all variables that have to be considered. And so that all of these fields within field phenomenon that are happening are of major concern and major importance in terms of trying to understand what we're looking at. Oh, you got one of those. Let me have that. More state of the art. That would help a lot. Right. There we go. I might even make it back here where my notes are. All right. You all recognize this gentleman. Dr. Einstein was very, very important in describing several things that affect us every day, that affect us in ways, particularly in the realm of subtle energies. Interestingly enough, some of the equations that he developed for unified field theory and for relativistic physics have been expanded in unusual ways recently. Now, one of the things I'll share with you later, maybe I won't put it on the board because there's not enough of you here probably that are interested in the mechanics of physics and the mathematical level, but I worked with Uri Geller and I'll show you some photographs with him. But I work with Uri Geller at University of California at Berkeley, and somehow he was able to tune into a mathematical formula, which I have a copy of, which is an expansion on Einsteinian equations, which Geller has like an eighth grade education. Somehow or another, he was able to write this stuff down and document it. And I'll put it on the board after the lecture, or I can show it to anybody who's interested. I'll put it that way, because I don't think it's of general enough interest. But I think it's important to recognize that various people, particularly Einstein, Tesla, Reich, Reichenbach, a lot of people have contributed very dramatically in ways that were not entirely obvious. It's something that we have to definitely pay attention to, is these contributions, and understand that they're very subtly balanced. They're very subtly balanced, the arts that they have contributed. Okay, I have that in my own. Where are we here?
Got more slack.
Oh, good. Uh-oh. Wait a minute here. No? What's happening with this light projector? It seems like no matter which way I hit it, it goes the wrong way. So much for that idea.
That's going the right way.
Okay, now let's keep it going that way. All right. Okay, very quickly, for those of you who are into electronics, one of the points in terms of the state of the art, before I get off into the Curlian apparatus, is that we've been focusing in electronics to get things smaller and smaller and smaller, and subtler and subtler and subtler and more accurate. Some of the specific points in terms of this have to do with instrumentation amplifiers, operational amplifiers, that they all fit on the head of a pin, and they have thousands of transistors in them often. And what we're trying to do is to create infinite input impedance. For example, in terms of the work of Harold Saxon Burr of Yale, he figured this out back in the 20s and 30s, that a very, very high input impedance was very important in terms of measuring biological specimen, and that still, 10 megohms of input resistance is sufficient in order to not load the source of the biological specimen, not load the meter that's involved. Infinite gain gives you an incredible amount. For example, the open loop gain of this of a typical operational amplifier is like a million times it amplifies the signal. You put in a little tiny signal, a million times comes out the other end. The output impedance is very important in terms of what you can hook it up to and all of those kind of things. One of the main state-of-the-art applications or implications in terms of microcircuit electronics, one of the things that happened at Fairchild while I was there was that they introduced an epitaxial form of super clean dielectric on the chip capacitor, which made it possible to do a lot more of a very sophisticated operational amplifier configuration. Before that time, the capacitors were not able to be put on this little tiny chip. When you look at the chip, you can see the capacitor because it's enormous if you look at it through a microscope. I mean, enormous compared to the rest of the chip. With electronics, one of the things that has come into its own very recently is the world of analog microcomputer technology. Now it's possible to use all kinds of different sensors to translate that information from analog with an A to D converter into a digital image, or digital information, put it into a digital computer, output that into some kind of a D to A or digital to analog converter, and put that out in terms of an image or create a digital image. The microcomputers that are available nowadays cost as little. Well, for example, right here in Texas, Texas Instruments just created a brand new microcomputer for $1,150 that'll talk to you. It does all kinds of very, very sophisticated number crunching and difficult calculations that up until recently have required what's called a mini computer, which is much, much larger, much, much, much more expensive. But for $1,150, a computer that can be your best friend. Here is some research that I did quite a while ago, in terms of the state-of-the-art. Here's an example of a state-of-the-art kind of meter. It's a 10 megohm input resistance meter. What we were doing here was, that's in the background, that's Dr. Timothy Smith, who's a physician and an acupuncturist. We were working on a system called acupuncture biofeedback, which is basically state-of-the-art. What we're doing here is measuring on needles the difference between, this was about 1972 we were doing this work. We were measuring the difference, bilateral semiconductor effect difference from one side of the body to the other on particular points that had to do with various ailments based on symptoms, so that when the subject could learn how to do the biofeedback effect to control the skin resistance through the meters having it hooked up, they could learn to control the symptoms. I tried it one time. We hooked up electrodes. I had poison oak. There's a couple of points right here that affect the skin in terms of irritations. We hooked up the meter to the points, and when I learned to make the meter do what he said I should make it do, very interestingly, all the symptoms went away. I stopped itching. It was amazing. Really blew me away. I mean, it helped a lot. I was in pain. Here's an example of the way that a very fairly not too state-of-the-art but still interesting operational amplifier, MUA 702, can be used as in a thermistor bridge. It's a very simple circuit. That's one of the reasons I put this on here, is to show you how simple, with just a couple of parts, and a thermistor bridge, for example, would be used to test changes in temperature, for example, to control migraine headaches. It was also used in parapsychological work by Douglas Dean in order to control, to be able to tell about telepathic communication. He would hook up the thermistor to the person on the receiving end, and changes in temperature would occur. So these fairly sophisticated state-of-the-art instruments can be used in ways that are very, very non-traditional by people who understand their overall way of being used. Now, getting off a little bit more into the aura, and this is taken at the U.S. Naval Academy. For thousands and thousands of years, people have talked about an aura, about the light around the head of Christ, around the Buddha, around various people who have reached an enlightened state. And what we've tried to do is, for a long time, and I've recently spent a lot of time with Thelma Moss at UCLA, and she did a beautiful paper at the International Curlian Research Association conference, which it described the history, how far back electrophotography goes, and how far back the questions that have been brought up about, well, it's just this, or it's just that, or it's heat, or it's just moisture, and did a very, very thorough and interesting discussion about that whole issue. And by the way, that issue is not something I'm going to get into very much today. Wrong way again. One of the things I wanted to talk about was a notion which was described to me by Andrea Puharich, who's a physicist and a mentor of Uri Geller's, who brought him to this country. One of the things that Puharich talks about is two different... Puharich is both a physicist and a medical physician, a medical doctor. He talks about two different states of consciousness. One he calls adrenergic, that means an excess of adrenaline, and the other he calls cholinergic, an excess of acetylcholine. One of the things that seems to occur over and over again with Curlian photography is that two patterns, two colors come up, and two kinds of patterns. A red kind of cloud-like pattern and a blue kind of sparky, lightning-like pattern. Now, it's been my experience that most of the time, this red cloud-like pattern is associated with a state of anxiety, a hyperstate, a little bit, Puharich would call the adrenergic state, an excess of adrenaline in the system. Now, this is a photograph of the tabla player Zakir Hussain. This was taken just before he was ready to do a concert. He plays tablas with George Harrison, and it was a very important concert. He was a little bit nervous and anxious, so we took a picture of him just before the concert, and the next picture was taken of his fingers just after the concert. Now, it seems that he was much more relaxed here, and it would show that this is probably one of the more dramatic examples of this difference between adrenergia and cholinergia. Here's the famous phantom leaf from Hernando Andrade at the Biophysiological Society in Sao Paulo, Brazil. This is the right shoulder from a Russian photograph. The photograph of an elbow. This is the same elbow after they stuck the elbow in the wrong part of the Curlian camera. They got an electric shock, and it does tend to break up the pattern considerably, as you can see. We figured, well, what is it going to look like? And we wanted to know what an electric shock. We didn't want to have someone shock themselves, but since it happened, we figured, quick, take a picture. That's the most famous phrase in Curlian photography. Quick, take a picture. Someone stubs their toe, you do it real quick. Let's see. Come on, you can do it. These are photographs taken of a series of people who are tobacco smokers. One of the things that's been known since the Russians did work on Curlian photography is that we can learn how to detect various kinds of drug states. We can learn how to detect the use of various kinds of drugs and perhaps some of the effects. These photographs seem to indicate a kind of a kidney-shaped blotch that occurs in people who smoke tobacco with that particular instrument, which was designed by Henry Dakin. One of the things that it might be associated with is peripheral vasoconstriction, which occurs in tobacco smokers. This is a fingertip of someone who's had some alcohol. A little bit different, like 14 ounces of alcohol. 100 proof vodka. In a laboratory. That must have been interesting, huh? Wandering around in a laboratory after 14 ounces of alcohol. Now, here's a series of photographs taken with a different... It's a sort of Curlian thermography, infrared film taken with a Curlian camera under the influence of nitrous oxide. This is a normal photograph under that circumstance. And as you can see, the nitrous tends to almost destroy part of the top of the fingerprint. Now, here's another photograph taken with normal film under the same circumstances. It doesn't pick it up in the same way, but it is rather interesting. And interestingly enough, this kind of purple haze color here only seems to occur with psychedelics like nitrous oxide, mescaline, LSD, those kind of things. Photographs of psychedelic or psychotropic plants. This is marijuana. Oops, upside down moon. Here's some photographs that are taken primarily for their art value. One of the things that interests me about curling photography is that it's very beautiful. It's fun to play with. Makes for some very interesting photographs. Here's another interesting plant. This was used by the Native Americans as a anti-convulsant, this particular plant. One of the things I've found is the drugs or plants which in their natural form tend to have psychological effect seem to have a much brighter, much more fuller image. There should be another slide somewhere. There we go. Okay, there's a couple more, in fact. This one's interesting because what it showed us something very far out. A long time ago, Baron von Reichenbach that Jerry Gallimore was talking about did some research with sensitives and found, one of the things he found was that they told them they could tell the difference from one end of a magnet to the other. And the way they could tell is that when they looked at it, they could see one end was red. And one of the things that happens with magnets when you photograph them, not always but often, is that they show up as they have red around one end. It's beginning to draw some correlations between electromagnetic, electrodynamic, all the different kinds and layers of electromagnetic energies and electrostatics. Here's a very interesting photograph. It's in backwards. You can't entirely tell what's happening there. It's very unusual in that what it was it's sort of, the image is sort of a backwards two. What this was we asked Uri Geller to, John Scutch in New York, work with Geller, and ask him to create a number two out of his, with his energy. And he did this repeatedly over and over again. Some of them were better than that. Others of them, this is very strange, but I've had copies of these for a long, long time. Now, some of them were very, very clear, extremely clear. I mean, well, when I looked at them recently in my slide tray, in my slide book, the patterns had sort of blobbed out. They didn't seem to stay. I mean, that's not possible. But it seemed that the patterns changed very dramatically long, long after the photograph was taken. I don't really understand that, but I know what they looked like before. I mean, there's no way at this point of proving it, but it's very, very unusual. And this is the least that has, as I said, blobbed out. It's certainly still obvious that something unusual was happening. He just caused an image to be created there. Okay, I think that's all the slides. I want to work off the blackboard a little bit here. I'm going to turn the light on. Paul, could you help me with this? I don't know. I guess I have a really long cord here, don't I? Okay, great. Okay, before I go off into the rest of this, are there any questions that anybody has about the presentation so far? Yes?
Has anybody ever done any photography of people taking hallucinogens according to some of the Oriental or Amerindian rituals where they will consciously ride the high, so to speak, as long as they can over an extended period of time and focus, say, on fire or whatever, as opposed to let it take over their whole consciousness? I wonder what the differentiation might be between the dissipation of the aura.
I'm not aware of anybody having ever done any research with that, but there's certainly an interesting possibility.
Yes? Which pole of the magnet was showing red on that slide?
That was the north.
Is that consistent with Reichenbach?
Yes, it was. Also, in Southern California, Dr. Caragula, Sophica Caragula, repeated Reichenbach's work and found the same thing also working with sensitives. She wrote a book on that called Breakthrough to Creativity. Yes?
Have you photographed the aura when someone is getting acupuncture and they're hooked up to the electrical stimulator?
Yes.
I've always wondered what that would be.
As opposed to being stimulated manually?
Yeah.
There's no difference.
No.
Well, you can't, you can't take the curling. If you took a curling photograph of someone at the same time as the stimulation, exactly at the same time as the stimulation, I don't know whether that would be good for the patient and in terms of the situation with the camera and the equipment and all that. But in terms of taking a photograph right after the stimulation, whether it's a manual stimulation or an electronic stimulation, or in fact, I've done some research with Irving Oil using high-frequency sound stimulation. None of those seem to have that much difference, but there is a difference between the before and after with any kind of stimulation. Very quickly, I want to just share something with you from Dr. Puhar, which I mentioned earlier. It's a little bit technical, but I think it's important. I think it's very important for us to understand that in order for our awareness to change in a way to be able to deal with this incredibly complex issue of psychotronics, incredibly complex from the standpoint that it involves so many various disciplines, varied disciplines, that what we have to do is, in a way, stretch our consciousness, really literally open ourselves up in very, very dramatic ways and stretch ourselves. And it's sort of like if you can consider your consciousness as though it were a substance or that it had some properties of a substance, like substance has a property of stress points, okay? It has an elastic limit. And if you can kind of think of a bar of metal, and if you bend it and you let it go, it'll bounce back into its original shape. But if you bend it a whole lot into like this, what'll happen is it'll begin to take on some of the shape of the stress. You're bending it beyond the elastic limit. So that what I'm saying is that in order to really deal with these ideas, these notions in a very meaningful way, you have to literally stretch everything. You have to bend it and beyond the elastic limit. If your consciousness begins to take on some of the shape of the stress, believe me, the information that's being presented at this kind of conference is going to stretch your consciousness. There's no way out of that. Okay, one of the things that I think is important is to keep up with the biological and medical models of the idea of psi plasma or biological plasma, bioplasma. Dr. Puharich has a notion in terms of this adrenergic and cholinergic state. He brings it down to the level where you start talking about the mechanics of it, the physics of it, and the mathematics of it. Basically what he's saying is in terms of, let's say, measurable differences in the nerve conduction in the brain, that you have various properties. You have capacitive properties, and this is very much along the lines of bioelectronics, like Albert Szent-Gorki does, who's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. Properties like capacitance, resistance, and inductance, and that you look at the difference in potassium versus sodium of a 10-to-1 ratio inside and outside the cell, that the nerve cell ends up being kind of like a generator. Well, that means that it creates a voltage and a frequency. Well, it's a very somewhat simple formula to understand the nature of that. Now, if you look at the nature of a nerve in terms of its charge and discharge capacities, the inductance of that nerve can be looked at as about 2/10 of 1 henry and at 1 microfarad. Okay, so that will give you a particular frequency, which turns out, in this case, he's looking at the cholinergic state of 8 to 12 cycles per second. Okay, so that what I'm saying is that you have to sort of come from an understanding both of the philosophical overview as well as go inside, like Jerry Gallimore has done, and created very carefully, very specifically. And by the way, I would like to really commend him on his paper. And I read his books about 9 months ago. No, I guess it's more than that. It's about a year ago now. And what I did was reproduce what he said, reproduce that crystal experiment, and it works with that same, in fact, the same meter that you saw in the slide, which was 10 megohms of input resistance, and it did work. It did change and slowed the dissipation of that capacitor by about 20%. It really surprised me. I mean, I didn't think I shouldn't believe him, but at the same time, something as basic as that, it really, really did do that exactly as he said. It slowed it by, it varied between 16 and 20%. So what I guess I'm saying here is that we have to look at all of these various aspects, and there are a lot of very interesting things in terms of the specifics. For example, it's interesting to me that in terms of electromagnetic healing, that if you apply fields of various frequencies, you can create, you can eliminate pain, you can create hallucinations, you can tune into various wave patterns. For example, the Schumann resonance, which is the electromagnetic field of the Earth, sort of has a vibration to it, and it's called the Schumann resonance, vibrates at the same 8 to 12 cycles per second, or around 10 cycles per second. And that may mean that in meditation, when you relax, that you may be tuning in to this very generalized electromagnetic field. Let's see. I think that at this point, what I want to do is sort of summarize my position and share with you some feelings I've gotten from other researchers. The first thing is something that I was told by Marcel Vogel, who I really like a lot, and his work has just been very inspirational to me. One of the things he's told me is that in subtle research, in research of the kind that we're into, and I think probably in research in general, that the single most important variable in any research is the state of consciousness of the observer. Very, very important. Very important. What does that mean? What does that mean? That means it's got a lot of different levels to it. Is the researcher really aware? Okay, how much coffee has he had in the morning? I used to get up, and because of Marcel's work, I had a plant hooked up, a Coleus plant, for about 2 years to a paper tape reading output GSR. I'd get up in the morning, I'd drink a cup of coffee, the plant would wake up. Every morning. Amazing. So is the researcher really aware? What is he missing? What does he miss? What does he not see? Because how much has he had to tunnel his vision in order to understand his discipline or specialty? How much has he been required by the physics community to look at physics, or by the mathematics community to look at math, or by the medical community to look at just the medical aspects, and forgotten the electronics, forgotten all the physiology or the psychology or all the different aspects? And that's why I keep stressing how interdisciplinary what we're doing is and how important those interdisciplinary aspects are. Another major aspect of this state of consciousness of the observer is that what we believe to be true is true and can be proved true. John Lilly said this. Now, I've talked to Dr. David Bohm and Dr. Fritjof Capra at length about this issue, and what they're saying is that in different parts of the world, at Stanford, at MIT, and in London, they're doing physics research, and they find that if this researcher believes that such and such a particle interaction is going to take place in a certain way, that's what happens. That they can, in fact, by their belief system, affect the particle interactions. That's very important. I mean, that means that at the most subtle level, the interactions are going on, and they're being affected by us psychotronically or psychologically. So I think that what's really important, and this has been in my experience, that we cannot really study psychotronics, and we can't really research psychotronics. It reminds me a bit of what someone asked me 10, 12 years ago, before I got into doing very much writing. And they said, "What do you do?" And I said, "Science fiction." And they said, "Oh, you're a writer." I said, "No." So what we have to do is we have to live psychotronics. And that's really where it's at. Because our consciousness, who we are, really is representative of psychotronics, our being, our beingness. And I'm very happy to say that I'm enjoying myself tremendously being with the beings in this room. Thank you. And by the way, this is the book I was talking about, Rainbows of Life. Oh, is it? Good. I guess.
Mr. Chairman.